Weird Tales, Strange Life of H.P. Lovecraft.
The most merciful thing in the world, I think, is the inability of the human mind to correlate all its contents. We live on a placid island of ignorance in the midst of black seas of infinity, and it was not meant that we should voyage far.
Most horror traditionally has been essentially a ghost train ride. You climb onto the ghost train, you head off into the darkness where the horror is waiting, and at the end of the story, you bounce out back into the daylight, the monsters are defeated, things were hard, but you're okay. Lovecraft doesn't offer that. You don't get off the ghost train.
The sciences, each straining in its own direction, have hitherto harmed us little. But someday, the piecing together of dissociated knowledge will open up such terrifying vistas of reality, and our own frightful position therein, that we shall either go mad from the revelation, or flee from the deadly light into the peace and safety of a new dark age.
He goes one step farther than a lot of other fantasy writing. He does not merely say that there are strange and terrible things out there, but this is in fact the structure of the universe.
H.P. Lovecraft never had a book published commercially in his lifetime. He placed his short stories almost exclusively, if that's the right word, in luridly covered pulp horror and fantasy magazines of the 1920s and 30s. In particular, the first and most famous magazine devoted to fantastic fiction, Weird Tales. He died in near poverty and was once contemptuously dismissed by the critic Edmund Wilson as a hack. And yet, since his early death in 1937, something remarkable has happened. Slowly but surely, the posthumous collections became bestsellers, championed by the likes of Stephen King, who has hailed him as the most important exponent of weird fiction since Edgar Allan Poe. Lovecraft has been reprinted by Penguin Classics and recently received the supreme accolade publication by the prestigious Library of America, where the volume called Tales stands alongside such giants of high American literature as Hawthorne, Melville, and Henry James, and of course, Poe. Like many readers, I first encountered Lovecraft in early adolescence. His Tales of the Dark Side wreaked a highly satisfying revenge on a grown-up world that looked by turns boring and frightening, and his emphasis on mysterious secret lore and forbidden knowledge gave his work a kind of underground cachet. Returning to his work after many years, I thought I might find only a maker of boys' toys, essentially an old adolescent writing for adolescents. Yet something about his obsessive vision stayed with me. And the tales, to my surprise, were well written, in a style which, though it has had many followers and parodists, remains Lovecraft's alone.
As a stylist, he is remarkably easy and remarkably pleasant, I have to say, to parody.
The British fantasy writer Neil Gaiman is among many contemporary writers inspired by Lovecraft and his language.
It's very easy to start listing your favourite Lovecraftian words. Mine are definitely eldritch.
It had been an eldritch thing.
There are word tics that he uses. There's this sort of strange clotted adjectival froth that will sit on the top of a story.
So little is known of what went on beneath the surface. So little, yet such a ghastly festering as it bubbles up putrescently in occasional ghoulish glimpses.
Gibbous. Things keep happening under gibbous moons. Gibbous actually just means the moon is nearly full. Batrachian. There's a good Lovecraftian word for you, and it actually means frog-like.
And inside that rusted iron straitjacket lurked gibbering hideousness, perversion, and diabolism. Here, truly, was the apotheosis of the unnameable.
My favorite thing about Lovecraft is the lengths that he goes to explain to you that he cannot tell you how bad something is.
Kelly Link is one of the most important new writers in American fiction. Her work crosses boundaries between science fiction, horror, and mainstream.
The fact that he brings you up to the threshold or the brink and then stops is infinitely scarier than her, that sort of shows you everything.
You know you're in a Lovecraft story within a sentence. He parodies terribly easily. But I think you can only parody really easily if you are a genuine stylist and if you are unique.
Howard Phillips Lovecraft was born in 1890 in Providence, Rhode Island, where the architecture of the colonial period was matched by his family's Anglophile nostalgia for pre-revolutionary America. From the beginning, horrors in his home life helped shape his shadowy vocation. The Lovecraft editor and biographer, S.T. Joshi.
We don't know a great deal about his father. It appears he grew up in the area of Rochester, New York. Eventually, he became what is called a commercial traveler. At some point, he was in Chicago on a business trip and apparently, basically, went insane. Had a nervous breakdown, was brought back, and spent the rest of his life up till the summer of 1898 in Butler Hospital, which is a mental hospital in Providence. We now know or suspect that he had syphilis. Must have been a very traumatic experience for Lovecraft.
Did Lovecraft ever visit his father when he was hospitalized?
Lovecraft himself claimed that he never did so. In fact, Lovecraft apparently believed that his father was paralyzed or otherwise incapacitated, and I believe that his family told him this as an excuse not to visit him in the hospital.
So with the death of the father, the grandfather becomes a crucial figure. What kind of impact did he have on Lovecraft's early life?
Grandfather Whipple Van Buren Phillips was a very successful businessman in Providence. He made and lost several fortunes, but he also took considerable interest in his grandson. He told him oral weird tales.
It was probably a combination of Grandfather Whipple's tales and his grandmother's death which brought forth the first monsters in the infant Lovecraft's imagination.
I began to have nightmares of the most hideous description, peopled with things which I called night gaunts, a compound word of my own coinage. In dreams, they were wont to whirl me through space at a sickening rate of speed, the while fretting and impelling me with their detestable tridents. It is fully 15 years, aye, more, since I have seen a night gaunt. But even now, when half asleep and drifting vaguely along over a sea of childhood thoughts, I feel a thrill of fear and instinctively struggle to keep awake. That was my own prayer back in 96, to keep awake and ward off the night gaunts.
The night gaunts may have spooked Lovecraft, but they also prefigured his habit in later life of drawing on the content of his most vivid dreams for transmutation into weird tales, like a pulp Coleridge or Thomas De Quincey. His imagination was also fired by the books that abounded in the rambling first house in Angel Street, shared with his grandfather and his mother. These included at least one first edition of Cotton Mather, a figure from the dark American past of witch trials and demonic possession. Of more interest to the infant author, who began writing in verse at the age of 6, were the 18th-century translations of Homer and Ovid. Lovecraft continued to show signs of astonishing precocity. At the age of 8, threatened with compulsory enrollment in dancing class, he promptly responded, "Nemo ferre saltat sobrius, nisi forti insanit," a quotation from Cicero to the effect that no sober person dances unless he be insane. It's one of the many ironies of Lovecraft's life that his papers and manuscripts are now housed in the John Hay Library at Brown University. Brown was a model for Miskatonic University, the imaginary institution that recurs in the stories, and where Lovecraft mischievously deposits a copy of his invented book of ancient evil, the Necronomicon, to be consulted at your peril. Because his nervous disposition so often kept him at home, Lovecraft never graduated from high school, so his dreams of studying at Brown, or anywhere, were dashed. Nevertheless, his papers, letters, and back numbers of weird tales are now all lovingly preserved at the library, where I met with the collection's curator, Rosemary Cullen, in a room strewn with Lovecraftiana, including signs of the child prodigy.
The vocabulary is astounding for a child of his age.
Little Glass Bottles was written in about 1896. So here we have a 6-year-old boy who already knows how to get the attention of his readers right from the opening sentence. Heave to, there's something floating to the leeward. The speaker was a short, stockily built man whose name was William Jones.
They show an excellent handwriting for a six-year-old, and one of the extraordinary things is that he saved all of these efforts. They didn't get lost somewhere along the line.
When Lovecraft's beloved grandfather Whipple died, his death hastened by the failure of his business, the family slid into genteel poverty. Lovecraft and his mother Susie were forced to move to a far more modest house along Angel Street. For the fragile youth, it was all too much.
Lovecraft had developed a great sense of place. All his memories, all his fondness in life had been wrapped around that rambling old house at 454 Angel Street. In many ways, he never recovered. He even claimed that for a short time he considered suicide. He would take long, solitary bicycle rides throughout the city and go to the river and wonder if he'd just plunge himself into the river and drown peacefully. And it's interesting, what dissuaded him from that was intellectual curiosity.
As I contemplated an exit without further knowledge, I became conscious of what I didn't know. Tantalizing gaps existed everywhere. What of the vast gulfs of space outside all familiar lands? Desert reaches hinted of by Sir John Mandeville and Marco Polo. Tartary, Tibet. What of unknown Africa?
The story of Lovecraft's moves within Providence is the story of a paradise lost. The original, the first house with its servants, its splendor was gone, and now we're at 598 Angel Street, much smaller quarters. Clapboard, well kept, but at the time a real comedown for Lovecraft, and he and his mother Susie, who lived here for around 15 years, occupied only the western aspect, about four or five rooms.
It represented to him the stark realization that he was no longer of upper class or of a rich family, which he had been led to believe all those years.
Marc Michaud, whose publishing house, Necronomicon Press, is one of several independent presses dedicated to Lovecraft.
The harsh reality of fending for yourself with a mother who quite possibly had been showing signs of insanity already when, you know, first moving here, it was quite a shock to him.
It's tragic, isn't it, that both parents died insane?
I'm not a doctor, but it would not be a far stretch to say that she may have suffered from syphilis also, because that would explain the insanity in both of them. I mean, we don't even know how often Lovecraft would have gone to visit her when she landed in Butler finally. We get the impression not very often, even though it would just be a walk down the road.
We also have to remember that his mother made the shocking statement to a friend that Lovecraft had a hideous face and that he never wanted to be seen by anybody because of his bad looks.
How would you describe him? What did Lovecraft look like?
Gaunt features, looked like he had a slight case of what is called the Marie disease, where you get the long jaw, you know, you would notice him on the street.
During this five-year period after his so-called nervous breakdown of 1908, he really did seem deliberately to avoid people's company. There are reports that he would walk along the street in a raincoat, looking straight ahead and with the collar turned up so that nobody could see him.
We're now outside a most curious brick and sandstone building, late Victorian, with a splendid dome, the Ladd Observatory.
Yes, Lovecraft had the privilege of being able to come here on a regular basis, was allowed to actually use the telescope here when he would have been probably about 15 or 16 years old.
It's clear that as an adolescent, Lovecraft was enraptured by the stars, but eventually there must have been some of that astral coldness got into his soul. It certainly gets into his writing.
The more he studied astronomy as life went on, he realized and often said how we were but little specks in the universe. That really showed in his stories how unimportant the human being was in the vast picture of things.
This sense of cosmic insignificance, this inverted awe, is central to the workings of the classic Lovecraft story. Lovecraft was able to escape loneliness by means of a remarkable institution of the period, the amateur journalism movement.
I think the world of amateur journalism, in which he very quickly became a power, helped save his life.
The leading American horror writer, Peter Straub.
In those days, the early part of the 20th century, from the teens probably through the 30s, men and women in their homes made magazines. They published their editorials and their essays themselves, and they took it as a serious matter. We don't have amateur journalism anymore, I guess, unless you count blogs. H.P. Lovecraft finally found a place where he was accepted, and not only accepted, but admired, because he was made president of his amateur press association within 2 years of his joining it. People valued him. It must have been immensely confirming.